Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your guest host for today, Jason Rosenbaum. Chris McDaniel is still on assignment. Joining me in studio today is...
Joe Manis.
And the General Assembly's biggest Wilco fan...
John Lamping.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Jeff Tweedy's on tour this summer, actually. He's down in Columbia this summer.
No, that's the reason you're not running for re-election, to follow Wilco
that's
on
right.
tour,
they have
right?
a European tour, and I think they're doing Antarctica this year.
So. Now, a little bit of a bio here. John Lamping is a Republican, represents the 24th District in central St. Louis County, and you opted against running for re-election. Right. You served one term, won in the Republican wave in 2010, and you're leaving. So that's one of the reasons we really were excited to get, because you were known as one of the more outspoken Republican state senators as it was.
Right.
So we're hoping that you will be even more outspoken.
Unleashed now, okay.
But yeah, that's kind of the reason we wanted to have you on, because right. you're finishing your last year of your term in the Senate. You kind of have a different perspective than some lawmakers, because you didn't come from the House. You didn't come from like an executive branch agency like Kurt Schaefer did. You're just essentially like a ordinary guy who became
right.
a senator.
Well, a world of finance. You're
okay. You're an extraordinary guy who became a senator.
Very
but
good.
But okay, just a very simple question right off the bat. What was kind of your experience in this crazy upper chamber?
Well, it's a. I approached it kind of like I was volunteering for a charitable organization, you know, so I'm very philanthropically involved with my time. And so how I actually presented myself to the Republican Party in January of 2009 was I volunteered to run for an office. And then ultimately they asked me to run for this office, and I didn't ask a lot
now,
of the details.
Now, do you think that they actually thought you were the sacrificial lamb? Because at the time, the 24th District was considered, well, was mm-hmm. Democratic-leaning.
Yeah, it was described to me as Democratic leaning. And for me, it was, I trust people. And I'd offered the willingness to serve. They asked me to consider running for county executive. And I said, that's fine, as long as I can do it and keep my job. And they sought out legal opinion, said you couldn't do that.
Right.
Couldn't do that.
Yeah, nope.
Then they came back to me in the summertime and said, well, what do you think about this office? And I said, well, do you think I have a chance of is it a good office to serve in? And they said yes. And so I said, fine.
Now, you ran against Democrat Barbara Frazier, who had been the president of the St. Louis County Council and was highly favored early on.
Sure.
But you got some key endorsements from the firefighters and others. So.
Well, I did. But I think there's two or three critical things in
okay.
that race. The
okay.
first and foremost, the fact that there was a primary. A very, very contentious primary. So you
between,
had
on the Democratic
between
side.
Between Frazier and now
Sam Page,
who's likely to become a county right. council member,
who had just in 2008 ran a statewide campaign for lieutenant governor.
Yes,
correct.
So he had big name ID and was very well funded. And between the two of them, they spent well over $1 million in the primary. And I think I got, for purposes of me winning the general election, I got the better. Barb was the better opponent, because Barb was more easily cast as a very, very liberal. Her views were easy to understand. She had a very long record, a voting record, both in the state and the county level. So it was easier to contrast, me being a complete outsider to her being, a very specific type of Democrat.
Now, when you actually won that election and became a legislator, did it meet any of your expectations, or did it completely blow your mind, essentially?
Well, I would say this. I went down to take it all in, to understand and observe. So I would suggest the first year was just doing just that and trying to understand how the process works. But from that, really about halfway through the first year, I started to engage in what I was involved in, similar to things that I've done in the private sector over and over again. And I did not blow my mind. I developed very quickly some very strong feelings for the change, the reform that needs to come to state government. I feel from the very beginning, it's a misuse of time. The session should be much shorter, much more focused. But I'm in the deep minority in that view. So what was interesting to me is how embedded, whatever you call how we do state government, as a systematic approach to state government, is deeply entrenched in the General Assembly. And I think it's completely inefficient. It doesn't serve the Missouri citizens well. And I did whatever I could to try to change it, not with a lot of success, because those that are in it, they like how the process works.
Now, what was your biggest surprise once you got in there and had been there for a few months, maybe right. your first session. What was the biggest surprise? Something that, that you totally did not expect once you got in the legislature?
How few of the ideas and legislation that is pursued are actually the ideas of the legislators. I have lots of my own ideas. Okay. You know, I try to understand as much as I can about issues. I have political philosophies and ideas. The vast majority of legislation I filed, and in some years, last year, I think I was part of 45 different pieces of legislation. The vast majority of my legislation, 90%+, are my ideas, are ideas that I choose from a universe of ideas and I put forward and try to legislate. And it's just the opposite. If you go legislator by legislator and you ask them, well, where'd this come from? It always came from somewhere else. It was shocked me that they didn't have their own ideas.
Did it come from lobbyists? Did it come from groups like ALEC? Where did it come from? Labor?
I don't know the percentage. This would be an interesting study. So much of the legislation comes from inside of government. It's governmental agencies that have lobbyists, that have legislative fixes that they need, that they don't get reconciled through the rules-making process. Okay. And then they file their bills that are filed. This came to us from the Department of Agriculture. This came from us from Department of Revenue. This came from us. And it's amazing how much of the time and energy is spent on those things. And if you look at what percentage of all the things we look at, just a kitchen table, mom and pop sitting down, and you explain to them, well, we're pursuing this issue, 90%+ has no impact on their lives directly or such that they understand. So I was really surprised by how few ideas. My second year, I actually got some of my ideas to the floor to shorten the session to 12 weeks and things like that. And people said, well, where did this idea come from? I said, well, it's my own idea. Like, what do you mean it's your own idea?
Now, let me ask you a question that came. This is a question that arose from the person that you might have run against if you had run for reelection, Jill Shoup. She claimed, and I think some Democrats claim in that district, that you ran as this somewhat moderatist candidate and you became more conservative over time.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard that criticism right. before. Is that accurate or not?
Here's how I ran. I ran as competent and capable. I ran on the things that I have done as an adult, how I proceed in my life. I'm thoughtful. I mean, I can sit down. You and I, Jason, can completely disagree on an issue. I'll ask you what your thesis is. I'll tell you what my thesis is, and we'll disagree, and we'll walk away and say, well, I disagree with him, but he's a nice enough guy. That's what I ran on. I didn't run on – there was no I'm a moderate, and you can trust me to be a moderate. I think what happened was that the people that decided to vote for me, they knew all those – well, they knew a lot about – a lot of people already knew me, and they looked at the things that I had done, respected the things I had done. If I had a chance to sit down and talk to them or hear, they had a chance to hear from me directly, they said, well, this is a knowledgeable and well thought out person, and that's who I'd like to see represent me.
Now, because I think like one of the turning points for your legislative service was last year when you filibustered the transportation tax. Was that last year or was that 2 years ago?
That was last year.
That was last year, now, 2013 for our listeners.
It should be noted that, Jill Shoup actually opposes the transportation tax too, and you actually won a lot of Democratic fans for doing that. But that seemed to be kind of a shift in your
yeah. Well, I think that's the one that's like that's what people point to and say, well, look, you went against leadership and all that.
Yeah,
and,
because as a backdrop, there are many Republican leaning business groups who are for
right.
the tax.
Yeah, here's what I was trying to say.
Just to
it was kind of like in your first couple of years, I think you were like a builder. You were putting forth a lot of legislation, your own ideas, and you were right. passing a lot of them. I think from that point on, while you were still putting forth your ideas, you also became more adept at filibustering things and opposing things, not only the transportation tax, but also Medicaid expansion right. as well. That's just been kind of my observation of kind of your posture in the legislature.
Well, here's the thing, is when I got to the General Assembly, there was a very, very strong filibuster. There was 8 or 9 or 10 people that had long been in right. the General Assembly. And if anyone paid attention, there's no reason why they should pay attention. I voted with those guys all the time. I didn't need to be part of the filibuster. The filibuster was aptly handled by that universe of people.
And Jason Crowell was probably one of the best filibusters in the Senate history.
And Jason and I were very close. We used to meet almost right away. I mean, I recognize, part of what you do is you recognize talent and skill. This is a private sector. You recognize who knows what they know, and you seek them out, and you seek their counsel. So from most of my first 2 years, at the end of the Monday session, Jason and I would meet for an hour or two, and I would kind of understand his thinking. But the first 2 years I was down there, They didn't need me to filibuster. There was plenty of people to filibuster.
That's true.
But if you saw how I voted right alongside them. Now, the thing, you know, in my second year, I sponsored Senate Bill 749, which is essentially the Hobby Lobby bill, which the Supreme Court is going to rule.
Yeah, which deals with whether or not companies are required to provide contraceptive coverage.
And most people think that the Hobby Lobby will prevail. When Hobby Lobby prevails, then Senate Bill 749 will become the law of the land. Now, I sponsored that bill 2 weeks after the administration came out with a ruling on Friday in January of 2011, and I had a certain number of people come to me and say, well, you're a moderate Republican in a pro-choice district, and what are you doing on, you know, sponsoring the Hobby Lobby bill? I said, when people asked me that as I was a candidate, where are you on these issues? I said, I'm where the Catholic Church is. Mm-hmm. Well, guess who's on that lawsuit is the Catholic Churches, too.
And guess who was a decisive vote in overturning that in the House? One of the people who's running for state Senate this year, Ed Schieffer. So,
that's right.
You know.
Well, I was also very proud of the fact that both the minority leader and another Democrat in the Senate voted to override the governor's
veto. And the minority leader at the time was Victor Callahan.
Correct.
Now, one of the things you talked about off the air that I wanted to, because this kind of fits in this, is, you know, like Jason was saying, and like during the transportation tax filibuster, where you had these business people who were like, wait a minute, he's from the 24th district. He's supposed to be representing, you know, more business, moderate interests. And as you said, you were saying that during the redistricting in 2011, which is a year after you got elected, you had some you discovered some things that you didn't know when you were running. You
want to talk again? I volunteered to run, and I was told it was left leaning, but we can win. But when we were doing the redistricting, you start the process where you're handed your existing Senate district with a Republican score on it, and I saw it was 40.8 Republican, which
meant that it was almost 60% Democratic.
And I told you, I said, look, you guys, I didn't know you when you recommended I do this, but if we're going to be friends going forward, you can't ever have me do something like this again.
But the reason I bring this up, because this does offer a backdrop to what we were just talking about, when you started getting heat from business leaders and major, you know, some Republican groups like the Chamber and others, because of your stance on, like, the Medicaid expansion, which the Chamber wants, and the transportation tax,
and of course tax credits. I mean, you were
and
also
tax exemptions.
Right,
and,
right. You know. So my point being, you got some additional heat because you had some of the supporters of those issues were saying, "Wait a minute," as you were just saying that you were supposed to be taking this stance because of the district, and you were saying, "No, I'm taking this stance because this is what I believe."
Correct. And to the extent, I think that the organizations that lobby for quote unquote business or the chamber, I think that it's a mistake to say they represent business interests. They represent certain business interests. And in my 4 years, their efforts were almost exclusively to either to carve themselves out of tax liability, either directly through tax credits or through sales tax exemptions, or to pursue tax, pursue more tax credits. And I think for every one business that agrees with their agenda, there's dozens of businesses that that I would be more ideally suited. My philosophy would be more ideally suited for them, which is just get government out of the way, make the tax code simple, have the playing field be a great economic playing field, but have it play a much smaller role in the economy itself. But that's not consistent with lobbying. Lobbying, you can't lobby for less government. You don't get paid a lot of money to have government do less. You get paid money to have you get paid money as a lobbyist to have government do more or do specific things to the advantage of your clients.
Now, I want to ask a more general question about legislative service. And this has been a question I've been asking several departing lawmakers. I asked this to Julie Justice. I asked this to Rod Jetton after I read his book. I'm kind of getting the sense that there are some people in the legislature who kind of get the culture of the Capitol get to them, and they put their family and their livelihood and everything in the backseat of legislative service and the trappings that come with it. Did you kind of observe that? Did you fall into the trappings of legislative largesse as well?
The reason he's leaving would show otherwise.
I mean, it's like, I think last time I was saying, I told you, we raise our children, it's God, family, country, that order. That's how it works.
That was exactly what you said in your last show.
Yeah, and so there was no way that being in the General Assembly was going to impact my relationships in my faith and my family. But I think it's a tragic, it's a tragedy that occurs over and over again. The culture of the General Assembly, you have too many people that are either, they're trying to become the person they want to become through through their time as a legislator. So it could just be for self-esteem. I think it's a career builder for a lot of people. You have a lot of – I kind of look – the two dominant groups are kind of the late 20, early 30-somethings in the House that really haven't established themselves in the private sector. But through their service, they'll you know, come out of the process in their late 30s, early 40s where they have a big foot in the door somewhere. Then the second biggest group is all the retired people. You know, so you're retired from all these other careers. You're the person you want to become. And quite frankly, the advantage of the retired people is that they're not, they've already self-actualized. They are who they want to. They're more likely to be volunteering their time. And those are the dominant forces. And there's too many examples you could see where people have spent 10, 12 years, 15 years, and now they're a high-paid lobbyist. The whole idea that people are pursuing higher office, well, very few actually do pursue higher office. Mm-hmm. You look at a state like Virginia, same size population, similar size General Assembly, well, actually much smaller House. They meet 1 year for 12 weeks, they do a two-year budget. They meet in the second year for 8 weeks, they do legislation the second session. The changes like that would change the culture dramatically. You know, we're one of those, most of the states, there's a dozen or so states that it's a full-time job. You make $70,000. You're there 10 months out of the year. Then there's most of the other states, it's a much smaller time that you spend in the Capitol. And we're somewhere in the middle. And it's I think it's a particularly inefficient way to run government. But it lends a lot of credence to the culture doing damage.
Because the reason I asked this question, I was wondering one of the sub-questions of this is whether the basic tenets of legislative service, by that means the length of time the session is there every year, the amount of money people get paid, whether that causes a certain type of person to run as opposed to another type of person. I mean, I think you're somewhat of an outlier. I don't think a lot of financial executives who are successful would stop what they're doing and run for the legislature. It is basically a lot of young people and retired people on aggregate.
Right, and if we had a 12-week, 8-week session, you get a different caliber of people would run. It's one thing to go to your employer and say, look, I'm going to do this for 90 days. An employer might say, okay, well, that's 90 days. We'll figure it out. You say 5 months, and I don't think
every year.
Every year.
And they're getting paid under $35,000.
So, mm-hmm. If you need to raise a family and you're in your 30s and you have a career, I mean, people are probably not going to leave their job to run for the legislature unless they are really politically active or super ambitious.
Yes.
So. Now, was there any particular groups you mentioned that the two blocks, which are the retirees and the young up-and-comers, did you have any observations about which group was more effective or if term limits played a role in some of this? I'm interested in your thoughts.
Well, I just observing the House from kind of the outside looking in. But the challenge you have is that in order to move a legislative agenda, you need to be moving towards leadership as fast as you possibly can. They set the agenda, and they decide what direction you're going to go in. I know we'll talk tax policy a little bit later on. They decided that we were going to do tax policy the way we did it this year. So if you get into office and you don't jump immediately into leadership, then your ability to set the agenda is relatively limited. In the Senate, what you do have the ability to do, and it's, I think Missourians should be very grateful for the fact, is you do have the ability to check the agenda. And that's the idea that Missouri is a very strong filibuster. And mm-hmm. It's a very important role to play. And I underappreciated that coming in, just what that meant. And the fact that the agenda is being set by leadership, and leadership is so very often being dictated to by the funding sources, the special interest, that if that agenda is not necessarily in the Missourians' best interest, I can't change the agenda, but I can stop the agenda.
Now, this is something we were talking about offline when I was at the Capitol, but I thought it was very interesting that after you leave, regardless of whether you're replaced by Jill Shoup or one of the Republican mm-hmm. candidates, the amount of filibusterers, quote unquote, could be down to two, depending on what right. happens in, for example, the St. Charles County race to replace Scott Roop. And potentially, if Rob Schaff wins re-election, I would assume that he's probably favored to win re-election, but who knows how much the Missouri Hospital Association is going to throw
him in there.
Yeah,
he's a state senator from Western Missouri.
If there are, if it is Rob Schaff and Ed Emery and nobody else being filibusters, what do you think that will mean for
the Senate? It's a problem. And I think what's happened is that the establishment's approach, and again, the filibuster... they're fiscal conservatives. My 4 years has been all about fiscal conservatism.
Okay.
So there's a big change in the Republican Party nationwide and in Missouri too. And I would say pre-financial meltdown, conservatism in Missouri, we think Republican conservative Republicans, there's two boxes they check. They check the right to life box and they check the Second Amendment box.
Okay.
If you check those two boxes, then you're conservative.
Okay.
And then you're Republican, so you've checked the pro-business box. And we talked before what more and more what pro-business means. Pro-business means, you know, cronyism. And but what happened these last 4 years is that there's all the energy in the party, both the state level and the federal level, is about fiscal conservatism. Are you fiscally conservative? What does it mean to be fiscally conservative? That means you're going to spend less. That means you're not going to do cronyism. And so what's happened is that the filibuster was very big in 11 and 12. But what happens when you're part of the filibuster is the establishment doesn't let you move any of your legislation.
Now.
So well, yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? Give some details of where you had something blocked because of filibustering?
So I think Jason mentioned earlier. So, you know, I was able to move forward lots of ideas my first year. I mean, I had six bills that I sponsored past my freshman year, unprecedented. Had the override bill in my second year, you know.
You also handled the ARCH tax enabling vote as well.
Well, actually, I did not. I did not handle that. I actually just facilitated getting through the filibuster.
Correct.
For different reasons. We can talk about that.
That's what
I meant. My point is that's not my idea. That was
not your idea, but continue.
But my point is to say is that it was, I mean, I had ideas like I wanted to eliminate race from the consideration
yes.
of adoption. That's my own idea. That got floor time. I tried endlessly to do ethics reform, actually managed to get floor time on some of these things. Now, the filibuster you're referring to happened the last week of my third year. So that there was no time to kill my legislation because it was the end of the third year. Going into this year, we knew it was an uphill climb. Actually, what I did is
Your filibuster that you're talking about was the transportation tax in 2013, correct?
It was at that time, it was a 1% sales tax to go to statewide ballot. And myself and two Republicans filibustered in the last
Correct.
Week and killed it.
Correct.
And now I will tell you this, is that when the session was over, I walked up to the proponents of the bill. I looked at them, I said, look, I know you're mad at me. We're going to keep going forward, keep talking, we're going to get to a solution. Actually, I came up with a solution over the summer, which was to redirect existing sales tax. I took my idea, this would be a constitutional change,
right.
I took my idea to people who were for the sales tax, MOTA, members of the Missouri Alliance for Transportation, told them my idea, they love my idea. They wanted my idea to be the idea.
Okay.
But my idea was never going to see the light of day.
Why?
One is because it wasn't enough money. It was about $400 or $500 million. It wasn't $800 million. And two, there are many of those in the. It would have required that we don't cut taxes. We just redirect, rather than cut taxes, we redirect money to roads. And there are people inside of the universe of people that are going to build all these roads. They want the tax cut too. So they're all LLCs. They wanted their taxes cut. And they wanted the state to spend $8 billion to build roads in the industry that they're
in. Well, that brings up a timely topic because now a version of the transportation tax is on the ballot. It's 3/4 of 1 cent,
so that's
not 1 cent.
And that all came. So what happened? Well, we continue. I kept pushing and pushing negotiation behind the scenes. Let's talk. Let's get to a deal. So finally, we brokered a deal with about 6 weeks to go that would allow the sales tax to leave the Senate. That was a stumbling block. And then in exchange for that, there was a bunch of other things which I won't disclose, but there was one of which was
they actually reduced
the sales tax to 3/4%.
Yeah,
that was part of the deal too.
Now, when I was talking with Senator Emery, he said one of the reasons why he let it through is because he just frankly doesn't think it's going to pass anyways, and he wanted to spend his energy on other things. Do you mm-hmm. think this has any chance of passing in August?
I don't know. I mean, I know the power of money, so I know that there's going to be $5+ billion spent on roads if it passes, and so the universe of people that would benefit by that, for them to invest $5 or $10 million to get it to pass. I mean, what changed between last year and this year is the municipal league is official. They're against the bill.
They are against it, yes.
Now, whether or not they can mount a campaign or not, they need to raise money to mount a campaign. My opposition towards it was it just didn't make any sense at all. I had filed a number of different bills that would raise sales taxes, raise cigarette taxes, reduce income taxes, some of the money would go to, mm-hmm. I was trying to do, I thought we should do tax policy. We should do overarching, thoughtful tax policy. And we chose not to do that. We chose to do things like in individual silos. So, and the big things we did this year, which make no sense I mean, individually, some of the pieces you might like, but cumulatively, they make no sense. So the one was we voted to reduce taxes $620 million beginning in 17, fully phased in 5 or 6 or 7 years thereafter. Okay, fine. We reduced the size of government. That's what that was. But at the same time we were doing that, over here, we were going to go to a vote of the people to raise taxes initially, to raise taxes $800 million. We're going to raise taxes immediately. We're going to raise sales taxes immediately. And then with the idea being that somewhere in the future, we would slowly start to lower taxes. But the net effect, the 0.75% tax, what that does is it equalizes the taxes eventually. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, government doesn't grow. Now, and then the third thing we did, got very little press, is these guys voted to raise our debt ceiling by 45% to primarily use the bond proceeds to fund deferred maintenance projects, which they publicly acknowledged they had not budgeted for correctly all the time that we were in the majority. Mm-hmm. So think about it. Republican Party voted to raise taxes now, cut them later, borrow money now to make up for the fact we hadn't budgeted appropriately. All those pieces put together make no sense to me, and that's why, I had hoped we'd move towards like an overarching, consistent, thoughtful policy. We did not.
Now that leads me to my next question. I think it was a question you wanted, Joe wanted to ask about the governor and kind of his philosophy, because I remember he put out a press release where he obviously was mainly against the tax cut, but he also criticized the sales tax increase, which, breaking news, he now officially opposes. He also criticized tax credits. Yeah. Such as low income and historic.
The fiscal conservatives during the special session for Boeing, we negotiated to let the Boeing credits go through in exchange for the government effort to help us cap the tax credits.
And he also criticized bonding and education. Now, obviously, you were on the pro side of the school transfer bill, but all those three other things, I read it. I was like, is this a press release from John Lamping or from the governor? It seems like, even though I know you haven't been on the same page with the governor, does he share some of your similar philosophies or not really?
Well, he was for the Boeing tax credit.
So, yes. So,
but no, I think it didn't take a very sophisticated thought to look at all the pieces and put them together and say, how does this make any sense? It doesn't make any sense. You know, who is for raising taxes now? I mean, who's for raising taxes now and cutting them later? I mean, how often do we hear from D.C.? Oh, we're going to raise spending now, but we're going to lower it later. I mean, the OMB score in years 9 and 10 are all positive. I mean, so that's ridiculous. And I think for the governor to say, that's ridiculous. You're going to raise taxes now and lower them later. That doesn't make any sense. And then the bonding thing, the same thing. And I mean, the good news, I think they're going to veto the bonding for the deferred maintenance project. So.
Well, but does that hurt some things that need to be done in the state? I mean, and what would be your alternate proposal of how to deal with some of that deferred maintenance and tax credits? I do want to talk to you about that because you and the governor were on the same side as trying to get rid of them or rid of most of them. I'm interested in your
take on
that.
I don't think it was getting rid of them, but I think it was severely.
Commission caps.
And I didn't mean to say severely, but curtailing them considerably.
Because they now cost the state more than $600 million a year. Do you think with the tax cut now be starting to be phased in a few years, is that going to put more pressure on to get rid of some of those tax credits or to curtail them, since if they're rising as revenues are being reduced because of tax cuts, does that put pressure to change the tax credit
policy?
No,
it will take an extraordinary effort by the executive branch to put caps on the two largest tax credit programs.
Which is low income and historic.
Right.
But
yeah,
continue.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Why?
All by themselves. Okay, now what I would expect you to see, and what's always been put forward each of the last couple of years, is that you will see the creation or extension of a series of new tax credits. And that's how you'll get to a cap. So it'll be a faux cap. It'll be not a very meaningful cap. Heck, that legislation was pursued this year. The bill that came out of the House was supposed to be a jobs bill, which that drives me crazy. I mean, the whole idea of government spends money is the jobs bill. It drives me absolutely crazy. But that proposal was to introduce 4 or 5 or 6 new tax credit programs, put slight caps on the existing programs, but it would spend $25 million or more the very first year. So what I think will happen, you'll see no movement at all in terms of rolling back tax credits by themselves the next 2 years, but you will see the Republican majorities will try to expand and introduce a whole series of new tax credits. They will.
Why? Why would they do that?
Because they think that's what their job is. They think that's what they think they're sent there to do. and or there are people that are asking them very specifically to do this thing. I mean, one of the things that's kind of crazy, I think that the state is run by 100 or 200 people. You know, and that's about it, sadly.
Okay,
and
can you talk about that? Who some of those people
am
are?
I one of those 200 people?
Not yet.
No, 201. Jason.
I thought my silky voice was enough to run
a
state.
I don't think either
of us. No, but somebody represents an industry, has an idea for a credit, a tax credit or a tax exemption, and they put it in terms that that they can suggest how the state would be so much better off if we pursued this industry. And then they go and they find a sponsor and they push it and they push 2 or 3 or 4 years and it ultimately happens or doesn't happen. So what I think you'll see next year is there'll be a bunch of people say, oh, we're finally doing tax credit reform. That'll be the headline. We're finally doing tax credit reform. The details will be that they'll be introducing 3 or 4 or 5 new tax credit programs.
Now, I just want to play devil's advocate here, because when we're talking about historic and low income, it has some pretty boisterous supporters who say that those tax credits do a lot of good.
And many of those are Democrats.
Well, how would you push back and say this isn't a reasonable use of governmental expenditures to do either of those two things?
Missouri has the largest or the second largest historical tax credit program in the entire country.
Correct.
Okay, so it's not a question of are they good ideas or bad ideas. It's just they're just too big. And the same for low-income housing. Our low-income housing tax credit program is somewhere to only 8-9 total states have the same, both state and federal. So it took a lot of legislative effort to create these programs. These programs are wildly profitable to those that use them, though they'll come back and tell you they're not wildly profitable. They are very well protected. In these next 2 years, there's no chance that you will cap those two programs by themselves. No chance at all. Never happened. There is a chance that they'll get some caps in exchange for a bunch of new programs. It'll cost the state more money immediately. It will not be reform. It'll be data center credit, freight forwarder credit. I mean, there's a long list of credits that will come out. And it'll be marketed as, oh, we did reform. Look, we capped these two programs.
Now, I want to get back to these 100 or 200 people.
Right.
Joking aside, are these people in government? Is it a mix of people
mix.
In
it's
government
it's,
and
it's,
business
it's,
leaders?
It's,
how would you characterize
well,
that?
Well, it's the lobbyists for business groups. So, it's the business groups themselves, lobbyists for the groups. It's all the different labor leaders. It could be trial attorneys, teacher advocates. You know, again, these are all people that are their job is to advocate inside of government. Individual business leaders, business groups. Different PACs on both sides of the aisle. Could be PACs that are interested in alternative energy, and there could be PACs that are interested in more conservative principles. And to the extent that each of those groups have members, then maybe the members, to the extent the members know exactly what they're advocating for, I'm not so sure. So at the end of the day, and I've actually shared this with other people who have been around government a lot longer than I, and they say, oh, you're wrong. It's not 200 people. It's probably 50 or 60.
Well, let's have a little bit of the backdrop of what the race to succeed you is. You have Jill Shoup, who's been on this show before, has raised a lot of money, and I think is by all intents and purposes seen as a strong candidate. And then you have three Republicans who are running.
Right.
I think there are really two ones.
Right.
Jack Spooner and Jay Ashcroft. Mm-hmm. Jay Ashcroft obviously is the son of former auditor, governor, U.S. Senator, and Attorney General John Ashcroft. Now, do you think that Republicans are going to be able to keep that seat, or do you think that that might be one of the seats that goes Democratic this year?
I think it's a big challenge. So, again, it's 45-55. That's the score.
Yeah, but that's assuming you have
a
strong turnout, and Democrats often don't turn out well in off years.
I understand that. When you look around the state, though, when you look at any seat that's 45-55, Democrat or Republican, it often is times where there's not even a race. So, I mean, again, it's yes,
right.
I agree with the fact that it's an off-cycle election that narrows the spread. There's nothing, it's not a lot to vote for in November that helps Republicans, traditionally Republican voters, come to vote whenever there's a chance to vote. Democrats vote more so in presidential years. But it's kind of flipped this time. So last time when I ran, there was a very contentious, high-profile primary on the Democratic side. And this time we've got a primary in the Republican side.
Well, and you also had the Republican wave at the top. There was this, huge, very competitive Senate race. And then there was the Republican wave nationally. And it ended up being that Roy Blunt handily won. I mean, Tom Schweik knocked off the state auditor.
All those things were true.
Which, didn't that kind of help you a little bit?
Well, but except that we actually had less turnout than we projected.
Okay.
And you only won by
100 votes.
100 votes or so. But continue.
Yeah. So so I think that the challenge is multiple fold. So it's a Democratic district that doesn't have a primary. Has a candidate, Jill, who's been in elective office of some sort or the other for the better part of a decade. You know, school board, Creve Coeur Council, House Rep. The Democrats completely cleared the field for her well in advance. And so she's been, you know, I ran a very serious 14-month campaign, you know, day after day after day, boots on the ground in the community. She's been doing the same thing for a couple of years. And right. So she's a very, so now the challenge, now the thing with Jill is, I mean, Jill is, I heard on your show last fall, she was already campaigning. She's a bipartisan, moved to the center, worked with Republican type of candidate, which of course is not true at all. I mean, she will be probably the most, if she were to get to the state senate, she'd be the most liberal state senator. And I think actually she'd be the spokesperson for lots and lots of liberal causes. I you know, I as a state senator, I interact with everybody in my district, and there are a lot of very strong liberal voices in
my
district.
But is that necessarily a downside in that district? I mean, some people might like
well,
that.
I think we'll find out, yeah. You know?
Now, I've got a story, since Jason brought this up, self-advertising, I've got a story which may be on the site by the time people are listening to this, which has some exclusive stuff about Shoup and Ashcroft as far as some stuff that's being rolled out in the next couple weeks, which the bottom line is there's a bunch of big heavy hitters who are coming in for both sides this month.
Now, are you endorsing in that race?
No, I'm not. And, you know, again, and Jack Spooner's the other candidate, and Jack's a, he's a remarkable guy in that he has tremendous networks of people in the district.
Because he's raised a decent amount of money, too.
Again, I think if Jack were the only candidate, he would give Jill a very hard race. If Jay's the only candidate, he would give Jill a very hard race,
so
too.
It'll be, but continue. Yeah.
So, but no, it was interesting because much was made, you know, when Chris Koster kind of came out early last summer and kind of coalesced around the party.
I was there.
We got to go. So they need to put up some victories, you know. So I think this district, the 24th, this is the one they want to call a victory. You know, they want this district.
The Democrats.
The Democrats.
And the unsaid thing, of course, is that Jolie Justice's district is probably may go Republican. So my district
that will be an underreported fact unless you report it.
And I don't want to throw Ed Schieffer under the bus,
right.
But
now,
I mean,
Jolie
that's
Justice, so people know, is a Democrat from the western side of the state, but her district came over here. She was a Senate minority leader and she's leaving.
Right.
And the bottom line is that
district is Democratic leaning, that seat is Republican leaning.
Correct.
Uber. Yeah.
So
if the Democrats hold Jeffco and Jill wins the 24th, it's still a 24-10 majority.
Right.
Okay. So there's no gains will have been made, but I think it'll be spun aside. So
what's next for you? I think I heard you on the Senate floor that you bought a farm in St. Charles County.
In
is
Augusta.
That true?
Yeah. So
are you growing wine? Are you growing corn?
It's already grapes are already growing
you
there.
You grow grapes. I mean, so wine, Chase.
So can I buy some of your wine soon?
No. It's a century-old farm that began in the during Prohibition. Which is pretty cool for me because my grandfather was a bookie and used to make gin in his bathtub.
What's grown there now?
Great. There's four. The Augusta Winery nearby has used the land for about 30 years to grow grapes on it. And there's also a small orchard that a local orchard has tended to up until 3 or 4 years ago when the previous owner died. It's called the Sentinel Orchard. And
so is it all grapes or is there other stuff
besides
grapes?
There's some apples as well.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So there's grapes. So the homestead burnt down about 10 years ago. So this year we're trying to resurrect the farm. And then I'm going to build a small little home, like our empty nester home. And then when that's done, I'll move out of St. Louis County to St. Charles County. And that will be my eastern side of the state address. I work in Clayton, as you guys know.
Right.
And then I commute every weekend to Kansas City, where my family lives, my daughter's training. And that'll be another 4 years at least that I'll do that.
So
now let's emphasize your daughter's training for the Olympics.
Yeah. So 3 years ago this month, well, that was the hope. And that's the dream. She has a chance. She's a gymnast. She's
correct.
A gymnast. And in June of 11, we relocated our family so that she could train in Blue Springs, and it's a gym that has national team gymnasts. And so she's done well enough these first 3 years. We know she's going to be there for the next four. My decision not to run was an easy one because my family doesn't live in St. Louis County anymore, and I have to commute there.
It was not surprising, but I think generally people were like, well, that's a good reason not to run for re-election, to support your daughter's dreams. So.
Yeah, well, I guess people were shocked. I mean, people don't normally give up. Incumbents don't normally not run for whatever they're running
for. Yeah, especially when state Senate seats, people are putting up 200 $250,000-$300,000 of their own money.
I'm shocked by it. I'm shocked.
That's a St. Charles reference. So I guess my last question before we let you go is, have we seen the last of John Lamping on the ballot, or are you going to run for like St. Charles County executive in a few years?
The short-term plan, I'm challenged by the fact that I go back and forth. You know, so that really cuts into doing any kind of grandiose things. I'm talking to a bunch of different groups about playing a role, some capacity, kind of more from the think tank research side of politics, and maybe pursue some of my ideas through them as a platform. And I think ended up on a ballot is kind of a random act of God thing. All the stars and moons have to align. I'm not ambitious towards being on the ballot, and that is in a plane filled full of nothing but ambitious people. So the likelihood that the C's part and I end up being on the ballot is probably pretty slim.
So do you regret running, or do you learn a lot from running? Is there one thing that you would want as a parting epitaph of what you learned from your 4 years in the state Senate?
No, from a personal and a very selfish perspective, it was a very intriguing and interesting life experience. It was really good. I've had the chance to go to school out east, work on Wall Street, do all kinds of different things, work around the world, raise families. I mean, and in the scheme of all those things, it was an interesting life experience. I have a much greater sense of the goings-ons in the world, I think, and how the reality of what is the political situation. And maybe it's something that's just that. It's just a life experience, or maybe it's something that it's knowledge that I build on and use some other time in the future. So.
Well, as a parting comment before we sign off, I just want to say that your staff, Janae Newstead, was one of the most helpful people I've ever dealt with when trying to get a hold of you. I email her, and literally within minutes, you call. I hope she gets another job somewhere else.
Well, this is an example for other legislators.
I don't usually like praise staff, but that was really exceptional stuff.
Janae Newstead and Holly Chuck were both on my campaign. My campaign was during the depression for attorneys. So Janae was out of law school. Holly was out of law school. I had a bunch of law school recent grads that are now in politics. So one works for the caucus. One works for Peter Kinder. I mean, they're all around the Capitol. My staff, I was blessed by them.
So to close us out, you can read all of our stories at sdlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Joe at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
And you can follow John
at John Lamping.
We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.